After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
What I wanted to express with this book is that even if you're not, you know, getting enlightened, like, you can still get lighter. And that's something that's really available to all of us. Like, even if we take a few steps forward on our path with whatever tools that can help us cultivate good attributes, you can set yourself up to have a lighter mind. And I think that's something worth aiming for and accomplishing.
Welcome to the Metta Hour with Sharon Salzberg, where Buddhist wisdom meets everyday life. This podcast is brought to you by the Be Here Now Network and features interviews with the top leaders, teachers, and thinkers of the mindfulness movement and beyond. For more information, visit BeHereNowNetwork.com/Sharon.
Hi, I'm Sharon Salzberg, and today is the return of Diego Perez to the Metta Hour podcast. Diego is a meditator, speaker, New York Times bestselling author, known by his pen name, Young Pueblo. Young Pueblo means young people, which is meant to convey that humanity is entering an era of remarkable growth and healing, when many will expand their self-awareness and release old burdens. Diego is a practitioner of Vipassana meditation, as taught by S.N. Goenka. His writing focuses on the power of self-healing, creating healthy relationships, and the wisdom that comes when we truly work on knowing ourselves. Diego is the author of several best-selling books, Inward, Clarity and Connection, and his new release is Lighter, which comes out in October of 2022. Lighter is a radically compassionate plan for turning inward and lifting the heaviness that prevents us from healing ourselves and the world. So welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Sharon. It's always such a joy to be speaking with you. I know our last two conversations were some of my favorite podcasts I've ever done.
So I'm excited for this one. That's so great. Well, congratulations on the new book. How does it feel bringing it into the world?
It feels like a sigh of relief. I've been, the hardest part is actually writing the book. So once that was done, it felt like, you know, I was almost there, and now it's just doing the promotional work, of getting it out there. And now I'm excited for people to actually read it. Cause I hope that they find it useful. Like the last one, like Clarity and Connection.
Mm-hmm. Did you write it during the pandemic, like completely?
Yeah, during sort of that second wave of the pandemic. So it was mostly written in 2021. Mm-hmm. And I wrote it in chunks. You know, I would write like 10,000 words 1 month and then skip a month and then do another sort of like 10, 20,000 words. And so it was written over like an eight month period.
I have a book coming out in 2023 that was written. It's the only book I've ever written without any travel.
Oh, wow.
You know, where I wasn't like grabbing an hour in the morning when I was on my way somewhere. And it's a very different experience, you know, I noticed. And I don't know what it's like to have a book now come out into the world as it is.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So you mean like when you were actually writing the book, you were in one place.
I was in one place. I just didn't travel anywhere. It was like, that's never happened before.
Yeah, that's why I would have to take breaks, because I would, you know, I would be home for a month or so. Then I would kind of be on the road and doing a few things. And that's normally just like cuts my creativity. Mm. If I'm flying or moving from one place to another, I really personally need things to kind of slow down around me for me to really put out good work.
Mm-hmm. And I haven't been in a room full, we were just talking about this, I haven't been in a room full of people in some years. So, and you're actually going out with this book, right?
Yes, I'm going to do 3 events for Lighter, and I'm going to do one in New York City at the 92nd Street Y, one in San Francisco at California Integral Studies Institute, and one in London at the Royal Geographical Society. And I'm excited because I haven't been on the road since 2019 doing my own book tour. Like I did one event for Soren for Wisdom 2.0 a few months back. And it was a beautiful small event. It was only about like 400 or so people in Silicon Valley. And it was incredible, you know, and it was funny because each speaker, when they would come out, they would all say, wow, I haven't been in front of so many people in so long.
It's really interesting. Well, I know you're very intentional with your work, and I'm sure that this third book is certainly the fruit of that. So tell me what spurred this particular book, this topic. Its format is different, and that it's very, very personal.
Yeah, but this one, it really... it's meant to hold all of my sort of major reflections, and it includes my life sort of intertwined through all of these reflections as well. So I talk a lot about my childhood, how it was growing up, immigrating from Ecuador to the United States. I talk about my, meeting my wife and how our relationship was quite chaotic before we started meditating and how we slowly started building harmony. And this is all sort of mixed in with like my sort of normal essay format that I've really grown to love. And the book Lighter, it comes from, when I really just first started writing, I knew that I wanted to eventually have a book of essays that had everything that I thought that was important about the healing journey. And as I, you know, develop my voice as a writer, as I put out my first 2 short poetry and prose books, something kind of clicked. And I spoke to an editor from Penguin. And after speaking to him, it felt like the right time to just really give it a shot and put everything in one place. So I've really, it in a big way, it feels like I've been waiting to write this book since 2017.
Mm. Here's a quotation from the book that's a great description. This book is meant as a bridge between the ideas of personal transformation and global transformation, to show that the two are deeply intertwined and function in support of each other, an exploration of what is possible when compassion is scaled up from an interpersonal level to a structural level. So is that the trajectory, the journey is experiencing, first experiencing compassion? Well, I don't know. Is it intrapersonally? It's for yourself, and then interpersonally, and then to structure?
That's basically the tone. Like the book really kicks off with my story. And then it goes into chapters about self-love, about healing, about letting go, emotional maturity, relationships. And then it slowly starts sort of moving outward. So it really hones in on the individual and what the individual goes through as they start embracing their own evolution, as they start sort of moving through these deeper thresholds of insight. And then it shows how these changes don't stay within you. They ripple outward and they start affecting the world. And I've always thought that it was really important to connect the two together, especially with my background in activism from growing up. Like I knew how important it is to mobilize with other people and to try to make the world much more humanistic, to keep supporting human dignity so that we can all have the opportunity to flourish. And I knew from my own studies of history that was always something that was missing, was that there were always beautiful people who would get together and have these wonderful ideals and they would actually sometimes be successful and they would gain power. But then power functions in a manner where it's like a magnet on the ego and it pulls out the roughest parts. So if you don't do your inner work to heal yourself or take steps forward on the path of liberation, then you're going to succumb to this trap that many people fall into all throughout history, where they, you know, fight, they try to change the world for a better place, they gain power, and then they end up recreating the thing that they were fighting against initially. Mm-hmm. So I think that's what's missing from this idea of global change, is connecting it with personal change, with personal transformation. And that's really what gives me hope for this century, is that there are millions of people around the world who are using Eastern modalities, Western modalities, indigenous modalities, and so on, that are actively healing themselves in a way that I think is just unprecedented.
It's fascinating, really, because, you know, first thinking about these things, you know, and also reading this description and, you know, things that you've written, and seeing, well, there is a path. You know, you start with, as I had just said, you know, you start with deepening some compassion for yourself, and then you write so much, at least on Twitter, about relationship and, you know, and developing a different kind of relationship with another, which is founded on love and compassion in an unusual sense, not the conventional sense. And then the systemic or the global or the structural, as you call it. And then I thought, well, I know people, as you do, you know, clearly, who are activists who start with the structural level. They care so deeply about others. And it feels insulting to suggest to them, it feels insulting to suggest that they care about themselves. And that's part of the equation that needs to happen. It's interesting. It could go in many directions.
I think it is. And it is interesting because I come from that world too, where it was like, let's focus on the world outside of us first. And I think when you function in that manner, the result that you get is that you quickly fall out of balance. And that's why there's such an emphasis this day on the internal and the individual and what's happening inside of your mind and heart, because those were the spaces that were ignored. Mm-hmm. You know, I think in the very early 2000s, like, wellness was something that was just, you know, basically non-existent. And I think there were a lot of people out there meditating, but meditation has exploded in the last sort of 10 years. It's become so much more popular. And I think it's sort of reaching this new sort of critical mass. And it's exciting to see, because obviously, like, we still stumble on the way and we're all still learning to respect the traditions that we're starting to find, you know, a lot of use in and a lot of healing in. But I think overall, it's going to make a very positive effect on the world, that people are turning that lens inward and they're realizing that they can be more compassionate towards themselves, that they can have a deeper relationship with their emotional history, that they can start just navigating their own sort of internal forest and understanding what's happening in there, so that they can build self-awareness. And that's why I like to, you know, focus on the individual, also focusing in on the relationships that we have, whether they're intimate relationships or friendships, because a lot of what happens in intimate relationships and friendships, that's really what society is sort of built out of, is that that's like our, you know, first there's one, then there's two, and then there are many. And then going outward and talking about the community as well. But it feels really important to just not erase the individual, and to understand that if we do have a good sense of self-love, the type of self-love that actually opens the door to unconditional love for all beings, then that's a good foundation to build on.
Well, society on the systemic level, you know, so often tells us stories about who we are and what we deserve and, you know, what we're capable of and all of that. And then it takes a lot of wherewithal to explode that story and not to just take it in and believe it and to say, no, you know, like, there's so much more I can experience. There's so much more I'm capable of in terms of compassion, for example, or love or generosity or presence or and to insist on that, you know, is a lot. I feel like when I have interviewed activists, whatever their practice is. As you say, there's such a wide array of ways of going within and establishing a different sense of who we are. No matter what their practice was, I found that as a common thread. Like, they did that, you know, that they turned around, because so many of them are working in a way that's fairly alone, or where in some cases even their families were saying, well, don't do that. You know, like, you're going to rock the boat, you're going to end up with nothing, and just be very careful. And they couldn't just be careful. They had to do something. And it wasn't ever just for them. You know, people would say to me, I look at younger people, I look at this next generation of people, say, going to work in fast food restaurants. And I think they can't, you know, we're not surviving, they can't survive. And I deserve more, and they deserve more. And so then it would take action.
Yeah. And I think that feeling that we get from the people around us, where it's like, don't rock the boat, it's pretty common, right? Because we want to feel safe, and we want to understand what's, you know, we want what's normal to us, and we want essentially what our perception already knows. It just wants its own perception repeated over and over. Mm-hmm. But the reality is that if we really want to build something new, if we want to have something like structural compassion, then we have no other choice but to do both simultaneously. Like, we have to actively heal ourselves, and we actually have to then use that new vibrancy that a lot of people feel once they start their healing process, and they can take that energy to the groups that they're a part of and ask themselves, like, how can my community change, or how can my workspace change, mm-hmm. or how can I, you know, redesign something that I really care about? And a lot of these things, like, it doesn't require like every single person to be focused on the same issue. But if a lot of people are sort of developing themselves enough to understand that, oh, it's actually not worthwhile at all for me to hurt another person, whether mm-hmm. intentionally or unintentionally, directly or indirectly. And if more people are saying no to harm, then what's left is goodwill.
Lovely. And I wonder if we can just take a moment and define terms, because we're both using the word healing, and it's a big theme in the book. And I'm curious what your working definition of healing is.
I think to me, healing is decreasing the intensity of the reactions that you experience. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of the sort of mental turmoil that we feel comes from just very intense reactions, and sort of reactions that have been accumulated over time, where they're the type of reactions that, you know, whether if it's a reaction of anger or anxiety or whatnot, they're reactions that are meant to help you survive, but they're not going to help you thrive. And especially those, you know, people who've felt a lot of trauma or carry a lot of old hurt, when they start healing themselves, they notice the difference, and their minds actually start feeling lighter when the reaction that they're experiencing is not quite as strong as before, or it lasts not as long as it used to, and they're able to sort of regain that sense of clarity. And I think to me, that's healing.
And then another term is authenticity, which is interesting, because sometimes, you know, it can mean so many things, including a kind of wholeness or integrity, which, you know, I'm sure is what you're meaning. But it can also mean, you know, like just a lack of tact, you know, like, that guy's an idiot, but he shows it unreservedly, you know, or mind who he hurts, because he's so authentic. He just says what he feels, you know, or something like that. It could be very different than that.
Yeah. To me, authenticity, I mean, when I was growing up, to me, the way it was defined to me is that someone is authentic if they stay the same throughout a long period of time. And what I've learned is that the type of identity, or the framework of identity, that is most going to support your happiness is a flowing sense of identity, a sense of identity that embraces change, that allows you to evolve as time moves forward. So to me, what's authentic is not your first reaction or your first thought. It's usually what comes after that, after you give yourself a moment to say, you know, how do I actually feel? Not how does my past feel? Not how does my defensiveness feel? not how does my survivalist reaction feel, but how do I genuinely want to show up in this moment? So to me, authenticity is all about slowing down and reconnecting with how do you actually want to show up in this moment.
And so that's why it's connected to radical honesty, yes?
Yeah, totally. I mean, and radical honesty, to me, it's not about sort of telling other people what you think. It's about telling yourself what's actually happening. Mm-hmm. And it's just another word really for self-awareness, because you can't really be self-aware if you're lying to yourself. But that's why radical honesty was a term I wanted to use, because what I found was that I was lying to myself constantly. So what I needed as a remedy was just honesty. And I needed that lens to be really focused inward so that I can catch myself before I would try to, you know, basically wrap myself in another narrative that would hide me from the truth.
I was having a discussion the other day with someone about the paramis, the 10 perfections or, you know, qualities that is really kind of in the essence of the Buddhist teaching. And one of the reasons I love that aspect of the teaching so much is that the paramis, which are like, you could say, virtuous qualities, like generosity, morality, equanimity, loving kindness, truthfulness, resolve, things like that, they form both the inner and the outer descriptions of what we're developing. So if you're in a traffic jam and you're developing patience, that counts, you know, that's patience. And then it's almost like the wherewithal, the reservoir of patience within you is that much stronger when you're doing inner work, when you're sitting in meditation, or if you practice generosity externally, you give away something material, or you listen to somebody, or you smile somebody, or you thank somebody. That's all external. But then the next time you are meditating and there are this barrage of thinking and you need to let go of the thoughts, that's an act of generosity, that yielding, that letting go of grasping, allowing things to arise and pass away. That's all a kind of generosity as well. And so they feed one another. So that's one of the reasons I really love that context of the paramis. And in the 10 qualities or the 10 attributes, there is morality, and then there's a separate one for truthfulness. And so that was the conversation I was having with somebody, like, why? You know, it counts within morality. It's a big right speech is a big part of that examination of morality. And why is truthfulness so special? Why is it separated? And all I could say was maybe it's about not lying to ourselves, you know, and being more truthful with ourselves. And so it counts twice.
Yeah. It's funny that you brought up the paramis too, because I've been sort of trying to, like, I've been noticing a tendency within myself to, you know, when I get really busy and I haven't been to a meditation course in a number of months, I feel like, oh, you know, I need to get back in there. But I'm trying to sort of get rid of this division that I've built up in my mind where, you know, that the Dhamma happens in courses or it happens when I'm sitting down, but the Dhamma is happening all the time. There's always opportunity for Dhamma. There's always opportunity for me to grow. And especially in regards to the paramis, like the Buddha would be born in times, like before the Buddha was the Buddha, he was born in times often where there was no Dhamma and all he could do were practice the paramis. Like he was just practicing how to be kind, like how to be compassionate, how to be loving, how to tell the truth, like all these sort of attributes of our character that are often weak and that we need to intentionally cultivate. And that's something that I've been trying to bring into my daily life and just show myself, oh, right, this is like, look, there's this great opportunity here to give, or this is great opportunity to have patience or have tolerance or have strong determination. And that reframing has been quite helpful.
Yeah, I think it's essential. And that's why I love the paramis also, and why it's been a very impactful context for me, because we're not always on retreat, even when I can remember when those were the happiest times of my life. And it's not always that way.
Yeah, when the mind's pristinely clear.
Yeah, really, and nothing to do, you know. Like, let me just walk from here to there.
Yeah.
It's pretty great, but it's not always the case. So let's talk another kind of concept is letting go, which is one of the core skills that's in any meditative technique. You have a lovely definition of letting go in the book. Letting go is essentially a profound acceptance of the present moment. And that's really interesting because sometimes we think of letting go, it's almost like being angry at something, you know, and we're going to hurl it away. So I'm curious about how you came to approach this as a practice, because I think it does take quite a bit of skill.
Yeah, it dawned on me over time that when we want to deeply heal ourselves, like the past is gone. Like there are sort of like energetic remnants of the past that we carry into the present with us. But if we want to deal with a lot of the, you know, like the reactions of anger, or reactions of fear, or reactions of anxiety, or whatever it is that's sort of really weighing down your mind, when they appear in the present moment, and you are able to respond to them skillfully, you're able to hold space for them, and you're able to sit with them. And whether you have some, you know, things that are given to you by your therapist, or a type of meditation technique that could help you hold space for yourself, there is healing happening in the present, but you're actually healing your past. Like, cause you can't go back there. Like, I think sometimes people also think of letting go as an imaginative process where they're like reimagining different trauma points or reimagining different, like, you know, whatever struggle it was that happened. But the tricky thing is that memory is really fickle. Like, it's really unreliable. Mm-hmm. But what you can rely on is how you feel in the moment. Your feeling is distinct. It's clear that you can feel what anger feels like. You know, you can feel what all this spectrum of emotions feel like. So when you're able to come in contact and accept what's happening, I think you're actually deeply unloading the past.
It's so great. And it brings me to the question about practice. You have a section in the book about finding your practice. And, you know, as much as we both were appreciating the paramis, which is sort of the expansion of what practice means into all of life, so that all of life becomes, in a way, our canvas as we are creating a different vision of what a life can look like. Nonetheless, you know, for me, I think that has absolutely depended on having a regular, formal, dedicated period of however long each day, where I am only concerned in that period of time about the deepening of qualities like mindfulness or awareness or compassion. And other things, of course, may intrude constantly, but that's not my intention when I sit down or walk or whatever it might be, you know, in terms of posture for me. But do you think some kind of formal practice is necessary?
Totally. I think we need to take advantage of this historical moment. I feel like a lot of us who are born now, we're immensely fortunate. I mean, personally for me, like, I think, of course, we have these really daunting challenges in front of us, right? Historically, yes, there are, you know, climate change, all these nuclear weapons that are in the world. Like, there are, you know, so many challenges in front of us. But at the same time, like, if you ask me, I'd rather be born now than in 1840. Like, I'd rather be born now than in, like, 1670. You know, like, to me, I'm like, okay, I'm glad I'm here now. Let's face the challenges in front of us skillfully. But at the same time, like, how is it that when we have such serious challenges in front of us, we also have all these magnificent tools that can not only help heal us, but can actually unlock this inner creativity and help us look at old problems and solve them in new ways. So not just for the sake of, you know, to help improve the world, but for your own sake, for you as an individual, for you to overcome misery, you know, doing that through one of the teachings of the Buddha or one of the paths that the Buddha's laid out, or through other methods. There are just so many other different beautiful meditation traditions that can provide you with so much well-being, or outside of that, even if meditation is not your thing, like having a therapy practice or having something that helps you engage with your inner world, I think is critical. And it's literally the best investment that you can make in yourself as an individual, because that's going to improve all other facets of your life, and it's going to help you decrease the misery that you cause yourself. But sometimes I feel like a broken record, because I am just like constantly, you know, when I get an opportunity, I'm like, you should get a practice, like whatever it is. Like, you know, you don't need to do what I do, but you know, if you want to, like, you know, go to dhamma.org, you could do that there. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, there's just so much out there. And that's one thing that I love too, is, you know, being friends with you and being friends with Jack, and also seeing like the new generation of meditation teachers that are coming up, mm-hmm. that are in their 30s and 40s. And, you know, I have friends in like all these different traditions, and it's beautiful seeing the way that different people, depending on their own conditioning, will connect with different things. And that's okay. That's mm-hmm. beautiful. That's something that should be supported. And I think the advice that I often give people is find something that not only connects with you intuitively, but is something that will challenge you. Like, it should be hard, but mm-hmm. it also shouldn't be overwhelming. You shouldn't get like totally overwhelmed by it. You should find that sweet spot where it's hard enough that you are becoming stronger, and you'll make progress.
It's really beautiful, you know, to hear you and to know you, but, you know, because I know there's even research on the efficacy, and there is some, you know, of mindfully sweeping your room and mindfully having a cup of tea and things like that. And it can make a difference in the quality of your life. But I usually respond to that by saying, that's like trying to do something the hardest way possible. You know, it's like, why do that? You know, like, it's hard to remember unless you're, I mean, the people I know who did that, honestly, most successfully were women in India who were in miserable, you know, family situations and weren't allowed to go off and retreat or even meditate, probably in a corner, you know, and they had no choice. That was their practice because that was the only practice they could have. And they did it, you know, whereas I know for myself, would I actually do it with that kind of rigor and intensity and wholeheartedness? Probably not, you know, it'd be like a story I tell, you know, like, yeah, you know, you can be mindful, whatever you do, it doesn't matter. You don't have to sit, but I need to sit. I mean, I've just seen that. And I also come down on the regularity. And I agree, you know, it could be journaling. It could be any kind of introspective practice that unites us with our inner world so that we can actually observe it.
I wanted to say, to just jump in, think that's one of, you know, I think in every podcast that we've talked in, we've always mentioned Deepa Ma, but it seems like a good time to mention her again. That's why I have so much love for her, because she is creating accessibility for the practice, like this mm-hmm. incredible, like there are these, you know, and reading the book about her, you know, the way that she would teach, like the mothers who were breastfeeding or mm-hmm. pregnant women, people who, you know, were so central to the household and they were so busy, but then these people were still had access to Nibbana mm-hmm. because of her. Mm-hmm. And that was something that, I think it's just beautiful, because there, it really depends on your conditioning, and also depends on like how much you've built up your paramis and how mm-hmm. much work you've done before this lifetime, because there are people who just come ripe and they only, you know, they have very busy lives, but at the same time, like a wonderful teacher like that can see them and help them overcome the tiny bit of dust that they have remaining over their eyes.
Yeah. I'm so glad you brought her up, because now I can just dwell on thinking about her for a few moments, which is great. Yeah, because the other thing that is striking to me is the idea of regularity. And for me, and that partly came from teachers like her, who was, she was mysterious, you know, because she'd suffered so much and she was so loving and so kind and so compassionate. So you'd think in a way she was like a wimp, but she wasn't. She was so insistent. Like if you did a retreat with her, there were no naps.
Yeah.
You know, you had to put yourself out there to maximum wholeheartedness, which was right and important. And, you know, that stayed with me in that, like, I talked to neuroscientists, say, who tell me that in terms of their labs and their findings, that we only have to practice formally, let's say, sitting, I think it's like 13 minutes a day, 3 to 5 times a week. And I say, well, first of all, I don't know if it's that healthy to go for the bare minimum.
Yeah.
Second, you know, it's like for me, I know myself, you know, like 3 to 5 times a week is not going to happen. You know, if it was every day, it's every day. But if it was 3 to 5 times a week, it'd be Monday. And I think I'll start on Wednesday. It's Wednesday. I'll do it three times on Saturday, then I'm done because I never do it. But every day is every day. And so we need to support ourselves and find the support of friends who will help us actually put a practice in place.
Yeah, I think it's funny. Like two more thoughts are coming up is that like the way I told you, I think a year or two ago, the way that that book just always makes rounds. And yeah. I recently had a friend over and she wanted a book recommendation and I gave her the Deepa Ma book. And you should have seen her like the 2 weeks after while she was reading the book. Like she was so lit up, like so inspired. And I think it's powerful the way that she brings like gentleness and strength to the practice. Because like to me, like she's like a titan of Dhamma. Like she's this immense figure in my mind. Mm-hmm. And when like in particular, there's that one story, it's a short one in that book where she's talking to Joseph and she's telling him to meditate for 2 days.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he was like, oh, the 2 days that like that a 2 day retreat, that's, you know, that's normal. That's fine. And she's like, no, I want you to meditate for 2 days. And when he realized that she meant to meditate for 48 hours and he was like, oh, that's too long. And her response to him was something like, don't be lazy, Joseph.
And that
kills me. Like I remember that during retreats sometimes, cause like, you know, like if you're in a 45-day retreat or something, like it's long days, long days, you're meditating 12 hours a day, every day, you know, like during that whole retreat. And there are these moments of, you know, you're sort of tired or there's a lot of stuff that's burning, a lot of conditioning is burning away in that moment. So your mind feels particularly heavy. But when you think of, I mean, Deepa Ma was a liberated being who was obviously part of the Sangha, you know, so she didn't take robes or anything. But I think one of the ways the Sangha is defined is anybody who's a Sotapanna or beyond. So thinking of her is like, it's just really riveting and kind of lights you up.
Well, she was an amazing being. So we are very lucky, you know, and that brings me to the thought about lineage. Joseph used to say, it always was remarkable to him that like nobody could run a 4 minute mile and then all of a sudden one person does and then all these people can.
Right.
That somehow what was inconceivable remained inconceivable until one person did it. And once we see that, there's something in us that responds. It says in the deepest level, I mean, I'm obviously, you know, not verbal on cognitive necessarily, but so deep inside that says, yeah, look at that. It can be done.
I think it's so true. It's quite powerful. I think the way that we like inspire each other as like a Dhamma family. And this is like one of the things that I wrote about in the book, right? Like normally when I write the things that I write online, they normally regard to conventional life. And like, I'm personally deeply inspired by the Buddhist teaching, but I don't sort of sit down and explain the Buddhist teaching. Like I like to talk about, you know, personal transformation, mm-hmm. I like to talk about relationships. And so even though, the Buddhist teachings like have inspired some of these thoughts, they're not dictating what the Buddhist teachings are. So, but in the, you know, it took a moment to explain in the book, sort of my ideas about healing versus liberation and how healing and liberation, they travel alongside each other for a while. Like I think they, you know, they can move together for a while, but liberation goes a lot deeper. You know, where healing can decrease the intensity of a reaction that was once causing you a lot of mental tension, liberation goes a lot further in that it will eradicate all suffering, you know, mm-hmm. that it will eradicate all the craving that causes you sort of all mental tension, all dissatisfaction, and that essentially ties you to life and death. And I think being sort of very honest about that, you know, I had to really just give people a taste of like what my own practice is like to just say, you know, like I know I write about healing, but I went to meditation, like I went to S.N. Goenka's courses for healing. But then as time went on, as I listened to him more closely, as I started reading Dhamma books, I realized that the Buddhist teaching made sense, that there was the opportunity for liberation here. And I think that was just such a powerful moment in my life that I had to find a way to sort of weave into this book that's based mainly about healing.
So I'd like to talk a little bit more about kind of heavy emotional states, because it really takes its own kind of toolkit to navigate states like anger and fear and jealousy and hatred, whether it's directed primarily at ourselves or in relationship to another or the world in general. And there's often a desire, I think, for many meditators that it's this picture, you know, that once we have an established meditation practice, it's all going to be different. And we don't feel these things anymore. But emotions, those kinds of emotions, are so human and it seems so normal. Feel frustrated when someone cuts you off in line or when you see someone being treated poorly. So how do we develop enough kind of emotional intelligence so that we can see what's happening inside of us and have it in perspective so we don't get lost?
I think that's one of the really powerful things about being intentional in cultivating emotional maturity, because to me, emotional maturity is the ability to feel an emotion without feeding it. The ability to just, you know, have a little fire inside of you that's burning with anger without throwing more fire onto it so that it doesn't become a blaze. Mm-hmm. It doesn't take over your actions. It doesn't cause you to start projecting onto all the people around you and start creating these like unnecessary argumentative narratives. But I think for people, you know, it really comes down to their own practice that can help them come back to themselves. Like for me, like I feel really fortunate to have a meditation practice. I'm only 10 years into being a meditator and, you know, being in Goenkaji's tradition. And I feel really fortunate now that like, I have sadness, I have anger, I have all the emotions that everybody else has. But what I have now is a tool that can help me deal with these things in a manner that feels a little more efficient than before I started meditating. Because like you're still like life and the waves of life, they're not going to stop. Like mm-hmm. once you start meditating, once you start your healing process, once you start really embracing your own evolution, life is still going to suck at times. There's still going to be moments of loss. There's still going to be moments of heartache. There are still going to be, you know, moments of serious challenge. And even in between all of that, there's still going to be simple ups and downs where some days you'll just wake up really tired or some days you'll be grumpy and there won't be like a dramatic cause, you know, it won't be necessarily tied to like how, you know, what happened to you when you were a child. Maybe it's just tied to something simple, like you worked too hard the day before, so you woke up tired. But what you do get from having a practice is that you have a way to respond to how you feel in the moment that's much more productive, that's much more helpful to you, so that you're not just getting caught up in identifying with what you're feeling, and you can just more easily understand that this is another temporary thing and that it'll pass.
I guess what we're referring to is the way we deal with difficult emotions would in conventional terms be called mental health, right?
Right.
It's not the complete eradication or absence of these emotions, but what's our perspective and how balanced can we be nonetheless? And can we be somewhat kind to ourselves even in the face of, you know, our anger and fear and so on? And that's what we call mental health, which is, we have a new mantra around here, which is mental health is not that high. You know, it's just like people are struggling, you know, and, you know, they're coming back to retreat, but it's not that easy necessarily to leave home. And for some people, it's not that easy to leave the apartment. And I, you know, literally have not been with gatherings myself. And I imagine a kind of dis-ease when I begin again, should I begin again, you know, like, there are people in the room, a lot of them. You know. It's hard.
Yeah. When and that does the gatherings include also not leading retreats for you?
I haven't led a retreat in person. No.
Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting feeling. When I first went out there, for Soren's Event for Wisdom 2.0. Yeah. I think that was in April or May, I forget. But it was strange. It was strange being around a lot of people. And what was cool about it was that there was just so much excitement to be in physical community.
Yeah.
And and I've seen that, you know, like I've throughout the pandemic, I've been really fortunate to go to retreats and to, you know, to be meditating with other people, even though the retreats were smaller. And obviously there was like so much protocol to keep everyone safe. But we would have these meta days where after the retreat was done, you know, we're all actively extroverting and speaking to each other. And it was just so cool to like meet new people. You know, I didn't realize that during the pandemic, like I was just with my same group of friends and my family. And it was, you know, always in these really tight, tiny pods. And I like haven't gotten to, you know, feel that incredible feeling of when you meet a new friend.
That's a really beautiful thing to say. It's really interesting because it's absolutely true. And unless you're really, really good at Zoom, you know.
Yeah.
I met all these people on Zoom. No, it's really true. I mean, for all of us, it's transition time. And so it does, I think, hopefully for the people who do have tools, they have confidence in about balance that help them pause, for example, or remember just not to leap into a reactive state and to forgive themselves for what they're feeling and understand it. It's never just me, you know, it's never ourselves alone. It's always a kind of more universal response moving through us and somehow navigating this time so that we actually re-engage in maybe a better way than we were engaged to begin with.
Yeah. And I think it's tricky, but it seems that like people are, you know, I understand the frustration, like so much time being apart from each other that people are so excited to be out. And it's still, you know, it's still tricky because it's not totally safe.
Yeah.
But I think everyone, you know, the individuals are measuring their own risk because at the same time, like I understand the need to live.
It's really true. I think when you use the word, it just struck me, use the word lighter. And many times we use the term spacious. It's kind of the same thing, you know, that if you're not locked into your reactions, as an example, but you can more see them, there's a feeling that there's space, there's spaciousness, and that what was once maybe very heavy and solid seeming is more feather-like, you know, or gauze-like even. And so it's all maybe happening, but we experience it quite differently. And in the Abhidhamma, in the Buddhist psychology, they talk about buoyancy of mind and those qualities that are about being lighter, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You're almost like bouncing when you walk because it doesn't feel like such a burden. But it's all about relationship. It's about relating differently to what's arising.
Oh, that's fantastic. I haven't heard about buoyancy of mind. I haven't started studying the Abhidhamma yet.
Yeah.
But if you have any good books, please send them my
way. I will.
I wanted to say, too, in regard to the word lighter, like I realized that I started using it often in my writing, even before I started writing the book Lighter, because when I first started meditating, like my mind just felt heavy. Like it felt so, so dense and heavy and almost like concrete. Like, and I remember when I like first did my first 10-day course, like I literally, like when I came out, like I felt like my mind lost 100 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and I didn't know how else to describe it.
Mm-hmm.
But as I kept going, like, and I think this became clear, like especially during the longer retreats, that like a lot of times we sort of function on this concrete, like as if we're walking on this concrete layer of conditioning, like all this old conditioning that we've accumulated, and we live our lives as if like that's normal,
mm-hmm.
right? Like it's just normal for my mind to be heavy and to be so tied into these particular set of habit patterns, and that's kind of what you have to work with. But when you know you're on retreat and you spend time just kind of chipping away at these layers, and they just keep burning away, and you come out and you realize, and you're like, whoa, like I feel so much lighter. And it does align with the word spaciousness, the way you were describing. Mm-hmm. And I think, and I the other reason I like the word lighter too, is that obviously I think, enlightenment is a real thing. Like, I think it's totally possible mm-hmm. to get up there and, you know, be like the Buddha or be like Jesus or, you know, be like one of these sort of titanic figures of history. And people do it, you know, it's still possible today. People are still reaching different levels of enlightenment. But what I wanted to express with this book is that even if you're not, you know, getting enlightened, like you can still get lighter. And that's something that's really available to all of us. Like, even if we take a few steps forward on our path with whatever tools that can help us cultivate good attributes, you can set yourself up to have a lighter mind. And I think that's something worth aiming for and accomplishing.
There's also an association which just struck me now between lighter is, you know, more buoyant, and lighter is emitting light.
Yeah. Oh,
which
yeah.
Which is beautiful. Wow. I mean, we used to say, you know, I don't even know. Did you ever actually meet Goenka in person?
No, I've never met Goenka Ji in person.
Oh, wow. Well, like, of course, he was my first teacher, which was like 1,000 years ago. And so we used to say, not only did he sort of walk like he could float in the air, but we used to say things like, there's like radiance coming out of its skin, which there was. It was like the light of compassion was coming out of him. It's like you could see this light, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And it was, I'd never met anyone like that before.
That's funny. I had an experience where, so during my first course, I did it in Onalaska, Washington, at Goenka Ji Center there. Mm-hmm. And the teacher who was conducting that course, like I remember, and this is me like, you know, 10 years ago, I was like 24 and I was super doubtful, like the whole time, just so much doubt. But I remember watching this guy when he would walk to the Dhamma hall, I remember thinking, like, this guy's barely touching the ground. Mm-hmm. Like, he's barely, like, he is so light. Like, he just seemed, I don't know, like, the, like he had this quality of weightlessness that mm-hmm. I remember mm-hmm. watching him and being, like, I remember describing it to my wife. I'm like, babe, this guy was barely touching the ground. And I don't even really know what that meant, but it kind of clicked now hearing you talk about that.
Yeah. I'm going to find you an Abhidhamma book for sure, you know, because it's right there. It's like buoyancy. There's another word. Like buoyancy, but it's not that. They have two of them, you know, they pair them up.
Oh yeah, please do. I'm like a super Dhamma nerd. Like I love expanding my Dhamma library too.
It's great. Well, Goenka Ji was so like that, you know, I mean, it was such a characteristic of his. It's like, you know, just kind of floating.
Oh, you know, I have to thank you too, because you set us up really well to meet Bhikkhu Anālayo.
Yes, I was going to ask you about that.
And I mean, talk about buoyancy of mind and lightness. Yeah, like yeah. Anālayo was like incredible. It was almost like touching a piece of history, like, you know, like being in contact with a piece of history. Because, you know, I hear about Munindraji, I hear about Deepama, like I hear about all these amazing, you know, teachers. And then I you know, we get the opportunity to meet Bhikkhu Anālayo, and I was like, whoa, like this guy, like there's nothing there. Yeah. You know, like I was looking at him in his eyes and I forgot who I was. Like I didn't know, you know, like I just like Diego, like all that stuff, it was just gone. And my other friend Rodrigo, who was also with us, he said it really well when after we left, he was like, man, he was like, there was nothing there for him, but all we were doing was we were just projecting ourselves onto him.
Nice.
And, yeah. And it was, but from all that was coming from him was just joy. It was just compassion. It was just Dhamma. And it was so energizing and inspiring for us. And it was funny because when it was myself, my wife, my friend Rodrigo and my friend Hannah, like we all got into the car together and we, you know, brought the food that we were going to give to Anālayo. But in the car right there, we were all really grumpy. And I don't know why, we were all so grumpy. And then when we get back into the car after we you know, spent like an hour and 15 minutes with him just like talking Dhamma. We were all so happy, like nice. So joyous. And we had such powerful meditations after that. And it was just like, it just felt like, talk about right action, you know, like,
yeah. Well, really, you know, I mean, good. It's really because you did it, you know, that, which is another great lesson in life. Because, well, first of all, I'm not a morning person at all, which listeners of this podcast probably know by now. And, you know, when you said you wanted to come and offer him a meal, which would be a very, very classical thing to do with a Buddhist monk, and he lives right here in Barrie. And I thought he probably just eats one meal a day. And then I found that it was breakfast. And you're not like right around the corner either, you know? And then
yeah, it's like a 45-minute drive.
Yeah, I thought, God, they have to get up really early in the morning. I wonder. And I said it in the most doleful way, like, are you sure you want to come? Like, this is breakfast, you know? Like, it's kind of weird. And then when the director of that center, you know, wrote and he said, you've got to be here even earlier, you know? Oh, God. You know? But you did it, which is the whole point. We have to kind of move, you know?
Yeah, it was great, and I'm deeply grateful to you for making that happen for us. And I hope next time we come by, we get to hang out too.
Yes, I hope so too, for goodness sake. So I want to just talk briefly about the last section of your book. The last section focuses on building a new kind of world. And I'd like to read this list of guiding lights you have in the book, because they're a lovely way to approach community and connection with others. They are selflessly listening to each other, sticking to our values, honoring other perspectives and ideas without becoming eternally attached to them, never allowing ourselves to dehumanize each other.
Yeah, I feel like this, I had to really allow myself to be courageous for this end of the book. I remember writing it and then reading it over and over again, and I really stuck my neck out there. Because oftentimes I find that people will want part of you, but they won't want all of you. You know, they'll enjoy what you write about relationships, but they don't want to hear what you have to say about the world. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I thought, you know, screw it. Like, I'm just going to be totally myself, and I'm going to say what I want to say, and just be really honest about how we need to be able to balance the freedom of the individual with the respect of the collective. Because one thing I see in history is like, we just keep swaying into extremes where it's all about the individual and then the collective is totally ignored. And that just creates a lot of short-sightedness and, you know, creates like this havoc that we have now. Or you go to the other extreme where it's just the collective, the individual gets erased, and then you get situations where, you know, you get like gulags and like people are just getting, I don't know, killed in mass, and it's quite horrifying. So to be able to actively balance the two with this framework of structural compassion, that the point of it is to support human flourishing, is to support the uplifting of human dignity. And I wrote this chapter in a sense where, like, obviously I don't have all the answers. Like, one person can't have all the answers. But what I wanted to do was just help start the imaginative process of like even trying to like putting the term out there, like structural compassion, and allowing people to sort of build their own ideas around it, because it's really going to be a collective effort if we're really going to try to, you know, even more deeply humanize this world. But I did feel like it was important to put a few guiding lights, because that's one thing you find in history over and over, is the moment we start dehumanizing each other, mm-hmm. it makes it easier to be violent towards each other.
Yeah. Thank you so much for that. Thank you so much for all of your work. And to close our conversation, could you lead us in some kind of reflection?
Yeah, sure. One thing that I've been holding myself to lately that I think has been really valuable, and it might be valuable to you as well, is asking, where can I slow down? We often don't realize how the whole world is moving at such a fast, fast rate. And now with our cell phones and with our computers and with our televisions, the amount of information that's thrown at us is almost overwhelming. And all this information requires energy to consume. So we get super tired just consuming all of this information. And not just like with what we're consuming, but how we're working, what we're doing in daily life. There should be some spaces where we can slow down, because in our ability to slow down, we can better assess how aware we are in the moment, how present we're being, and if we're reacting harshly or not. So if you can, take the time to ask yourself, where can I move slower?
Thank you so much for joining me today. To learn more about Diego's work, you can visit jungpueblo.com. It's jungpueblo.com. And please get a copy of his new book, Lighter, which is available in hardcover, ebook, and audiobook formats wherever books are sold. Sending my thanks to all of you who are listening. This has been the Metta Hour podcast from the Be Here Now Network. May you be safe, be happy, be healthy, and live with ease.
Hey folks, thanks for listening. To learn more about Sharon and her ongoing teaching schedule, as well as online courses and a free guided meditation, check out her website at sharonsalzberg.com.